Hey everyone, if you love listening to Curbsiders and want to enhance the experience, then now is a great time to join the Curbsiders Patreon with new annual memberships where you can save 10% off the monthly rate. You'll have the option to hear all the episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes. You can sign up at patreon.com/curbsiders. This is a great way to use that CME money that's probably burning a hole in your pocket, plus support the show so we can keep bringing you clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, mini-series like Teach and Addiction Medicine, our Digest newsletter, and of course, expand our video content. So join the Cashlack family today at patreon.com/curbsiders.
Hey, Ira. It's great to see you.
You too, Carolyn. How have you been doing?
I've been doing great. Love your scarf. Very stylish.
Thank you. Trying to add a little sparkle to what's happening, because otherwise it's very bland SF colors. The grays, the blacks, the beige. So, yeah.
I feel like you sparkle. You are a sparkly person. We don't even need extra sparkle. We just need, you know, your personality.
Carolyn, you just made my heart swell, but like not in a pulmonary edema way, like in a thoughtful way. Thank you.
And on that note, welcome back to the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, our mini series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Krzyzanowska. And on tonight's episode, we're going to discuss all things low-dose buprenorphine with Amelia Goff, nurse practitioner, and Dr. Elisa Sokolsky. But before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do?
Sure, Carolyn. And for all things sparkly and addiction medicine, we are the Addiction Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews to demystify common addiction medicine topics, reduce stigma, and inspire listeners to be fierce advocates for all individuals who use substances. Another reminder that most episodes are available for free CME credit through VCU Health CE for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And by listening to this episode and completing the CME, you can use this towards the new DEA 8-hour requirement on substance use disorders education.
Very special thanks, as always, to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, who have partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Med miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction med faculty and trainees, and they are dedicated to training and supporting the next generation of academic addiction med leaders. Whether you're an addiction med physician preparing for the ABPM boards or a physician in practice just looking to learn more about addiction medicine, ACAM offers several self-study products that help meet your needs. The Professional Practice Bundle includes access to 86 self-assessment modules that provide CME, as well as 46 didactic lecture recordings. ACAM's Board Prep Bundle also offers access to the 46 didactic lecture recordings, along with a nearly 200-item question bank and its addiction e-practice test. So to learn more about these and their other product offerings, as well as membership, be sure to visit acam.org.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guests, Amelia Goff, NP, and Dr. Elisa Sokolsky. Amelia Goff is a nurse practitioner at Oregon Health and Science University in the Division of General Internal Medicine and Geriatrics and in the Section of Addiction Medicine. In her clinical practice, Amelia works on the Interprofessional Inpatient Addiction Medicine Consult Service, also known as IMPACT, and also in the Low Barrier Harm Reduction Bridge Clinic, or also known as Harm Reduction and Bridges to Care.
Dr. Elisa Sokolsky is an addiction medicine specialist at Oregon Health and Science University. She works providing inpatient addiction medicine consultation for patients at OHSU Hospital and Hillsborough Medical Center as part of the Improving Addiction Care Team, also known as IMPACT. She's very passionate about medical education and loves working with medical providers across diverse settings to expand access to addiction treatment. They both teach us so many pearls today. I think one of my favorite ones, I'm just going to allude to but not explain it, but they actually give us a couple of great patient spiels on how to explain low-dose buprenorphine that involves steps and cars. So if you want to know more, you're going to actually have to listen to the whole episode, as well as they highlight that there are many different protocols we could use, and they walk us through a couple.
I want to just echo those. I think Carolyn's perfect. I loved their actual step-by-step walkthrough of what happens on day one, what happens on day two, what happens on day three, and also that they had to do a lot of kind of provider team education to really make this happen, get buy-in, and really see that it's having an impact and that patients enjoy it. So listen close, listen up. It's happening.
Yeah, let's jump into it. Hey, Amelia and Alisa. It's so great to see both of you today. We're super stoked to have you on the show. So we just want our audience to get the chance to get to know you a little bit better. So I'm going to ask each of you to give a one-liner about yourself. Amelia, why don't you go first?
Sure. Thanks, Carolyn. I'm Amelia Goff. I'm a nurse practitioner. I'm an infectious disease and addiction enthusiast, originally from Boston and now in the Pacific Northwest. Fun fact, I live on a veggie farm, and my husband takes care of everything outside, and then I take care of all the indoor plants. It's really great to be here. Thanks.
Oh my gosh, what's your favorite veggie? We're like jumping on the plant thing.
Very into, I'd say, these like little cucumbers right now. Just delicious. Can eat a couple a day.
Oh my God. So tasty and so cute. Alisa, do you want to give us a one-liner about you?
Sure. Let's see. So I am a 33-year-old internist, psychiatrist, and addiction medicine specialist who is passionate about medical education and integrated care. And when I'm not doing all of those things, I'm busy being an amateur rock climber and mountaineer and dog mom to a very, very opinionated corgi.
What is the corgi's strongest opinion?
That she should be fed 8 times a day and that 2 meals a day are not enough.
Well, you know, she just needs to go over to the veggie farm of Amelia and then it's, you know, galore over
there. We can make that happen.
We like to solve problems on the curbsider's addiction. So,
I mean, there's something about no fixin' in MI, but, you know, here on the podcast, it's all about fixin'. We're fixers.
And she loves cucumbers, so it's perfect.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Match made in, you know, podcast recording heaven. I love it. Well, one of the other things we love to ask folks is kind of what your favorite aspects are of working in the field of addiction medicine or addiction psychiatry, just kind of taking care of substance use disorders. And I wonder, Alisa, do you want to start us off about your favorite aspect?
I think there's a few things that I just really love about doing this work. I think that, you know, more than other areas of medicine, I really, really get to know my patients, really hear the story of what they've gone through in their lives. And it's a real privilege to be in that space with people. And also, since I come from a pretty broad training background, I love places where I get to integrate and use some mental health skills, use the addiction medicine skills, use my internist skills, and combine them in unusual places too. So that's been really fun.
I guess for me, the things that I love, I really enjoy connecting with patients and having understanding of what's important to them and how I can be helpful in those spaces. And then coming back from a background of infectious disease and then coming into the addiction space, the synergies of thinking about harm reduction with patients is a space that I really enjoy. And I think finally, there's so many really innovative and motivated providers and individuals in the addiction space working on health systems change. And I think that's something that I get really excited about.
I'm loving all the diversity that you guys bring to the show right now with all your multiple backgrounds and all the hats that you wear. It's really great to see and hear you guys putting that together in the space that I think really benefits from diversity in background, training, creativity, and all those things.
Vegetables, everything. Dogs. No, but truly, I totally agree with Caroline. I feel like the intersection of all that and the just different practices, I think, will give us an amazing discussion. Caroline, should we jump into the case?
Yeah, let's do it.
Wonderful. All right. Well, y'all, we have Mr. A here, who's 25, and he has a history of opioid use disorder, currently admitted to the hospital with an epidural abscess, who had surgical debridement. And he's receiving oxycodone 45 milligrams every 3 hours around the clock for his acute pain after that debridement. And he's not on any treatment for the opioid use disorder at this time. He says that he injects fentanyl 10 times a day. He reports trying to start buprenorphine in the past, but after waiting for around 12 hours after his last fentanyl use, he took one 8-milligram film and says that after that, he immediately felt like his withdrawal kind of was worse and his symptoms really escalated. And he would like to be on buprenorphine eventually, as he's not really focused on getting into or kind of not able to get to a methadone clinic. But he's worried about starting the buprenorphine in the hospital because he doesn't want to stop the oxycodone. It's managing his pain. And he's also worried about experiencing what he did during his previous time taking buprenorphine. So I wonder, maybe we can start with Amelia, what you think for Mr. A. He's describing this episode of, you know, stopping fentanyl for 12 hours and then taking a dose of buprenorphine and experiencing a worsening of symptoms, specifically worsening of withdrawal. Can you remind us why that happened and kind of what clinical syndrome he may be experiencing?
Yeah, definitely, Ara. I think it's really helpful to talk about the pharmacokinetics of both buprenorphine and then fentanyl and how they are interacting. So I think as we know that bup is a partial agonist and it's working at the mu opioid receptor of the brain, and it has a strong affinity or magnetism to those receptors that can force or displace other full agonists off those same receptors, causing precipitated withdrawal. And there's unique interaction if someone is using fentanyl, which we know is a short-acting, very high-potent lipophilic agonist, and it has a really long elimination half-life, and with regular chronic use can result in it staying in the tissues for the extended period. And so because of that, if someone takes buprenorphine sooner than 24, 48, 72 hours per research, can cause this precipitation of withdrawal because the fentanyl is still sticking around and the bup comes in too soon and kicks that off. And it's really a miserable experience for patients. Can be very scary, and understandably, folks will want to avoid it if they can in the future.
Totally. And I also want to highlight, you know, that part of this too is about like the amount of heavy use. You know, I think if folks like use fentanyl one time, they're probably not going to see this effect in them. But as you said, that lipophilicity, it really is what causes it to like sort of store in our adipose tissues over time.
Lisa, do you want to, was there anything you wanted to add? I saw you thinking deeply.
I was just thinking about, you know, how we really need more research too. I think a lot of the studies that have been done on fentanyl have been on pharmaceutical fentanyl. But there's so many different variations of what people are using. If they're using non-prescribed fentanyl, there have been some studies, there one study in particular that just looked at how long people continue to test positive for fentanyl in urine drug testing in a residential setting. And there were 12 participants, and on average, it took 7 days before they stopped testing positive for fentanyl, and norfentanyl, one of the metabolites, was still positive an average of 13 days later. And so this is something that if people are using chronic heavy amounts, it can stick around in the body for quite a long time. And just clinically, what I think we've seen, Amelia and I have seen working in the hospital, working in the clinic, is that if someone takes buprenorphine, they're really at that higher risk of precipitated withdrawal in that first 24 hours, but sometimes maybe even 48 to 72 hours after last use of fentanyl.
Thanks for bringing that up, Lisa. I feel like between the pharmacokinetics that Amelia walked us through and kind of that chronicity and the and what we see in the metabolites, we really kind of get a sense of how fentanyl works and its kind of three-compartment model and how that distribution kind of fades out between, you know, plasma and tissue and kind of adipose and how that affects what we're seeing clinically. How do you kind of bring it to a patient level to be like, I don't want you to experience that again either. And here's, you know, what we can do, or this is what we can decide about together in terms of next steps. Maybe at least if you want to start us off.
Yeah. So when I'm talking with patients about this phenomenon, unfortunately, many people have already experienced precipitated withdrawal. So they may be familiar with the syndrome, but some people haven't. And I think it's important to discuss that before starting buprenorphine for any patient. And typically, I'll talk with patients about how long-term use of fentanyl can cause it to stick around in the body for a long time because of the deposition in adipose tissue. I'll say, you know, deposits in the fat, it can stick around for days to weeks after your last use. And that means that some amount of it is still binding to the receptors in your brain. I think visual aids can be really helpful. And so I borrowed this from one of the providers I trained with, but I'll actually like put my hand up and pretend it's a little opioid receptor. And I'll say, this is the fentanyl in the receptor. And when buprenorphine comes along, if it's still there, it's going to rip it out. And then you're going to go into withdrawal. And I think having some kind of visual aid, or, you know, sometimes I'll draw pictures with patients, can be really helpful in providing that education. And I think that action of like the fentanyl being ripped out of the receptor and buprenorphine is like the gorilla glue opioid. It's going to come and bind in its place, and then it's not going to provide as much of an effect. And then all of a sudden, you're experiencing that precipitated withdrawal. That's why it's so important that we think about other ways to start buprenorphine.
I love that analogy, the gorilla glue. At the opioid receptor.
It's an awesome description. I do actually a very similar kind of visual representation. And I think knowledge is power, and the patients we're seeing are experts in their experiences and bodies. But often patients say to me, oh, no one's ever broke that down for me. And now I feel like I understand it better.
And given his very real concerns regarding the challenges of starting buprenorphine, what are the different options we have for Mr. A for the initiation of this medication, particularly because he is uniquely placed in the hospital setting and also has acute pain right now that he's trying to manage?
Yeah, so I think the inpatient setting, like you mentioned, is very unique. The most evidence we have is for traditional inductions, which would require Mr. A to wait till he was in moderate opioid withdrawal, which would mean holding the full agonists that he's on that are helping with his acute pain, and then initiating buprenorphine to control his withdrawal and cravings. I think what we have to also question, though, is there are more humane ways now, which is low-dose inductions, where the basic principle is that we take withdrawal out of the equation and reduce the risk of precipitate withdrawal. And the general concept is that you're slowly introducing small doses of that buprenorphine that increase over several days until you get to a dose that would be a maintenance dose while having full agonist opioids in the background for adequate withdrawal management, craving management, and acute pain management. And this can be a really important tool in the hospital setting, which I'm sure we'll talk about in more detail.
We will. And we can now, Amelia, if you want. Because I feel like sure. It would be really interesting to think about. You know, you mentioned that the traditional start does have the most evidence behind it. And yet we are seeing kind of growing reports, including one might say y'all's report of, patients doing well with low-dose bup initiations or even rapid low-dose starts. So I wonder, you know, when you're making this decision or even having that conversation with Mr. A, how do you talk about what that initiation looks like or could look like if you're choosing to not go through the traditional start because of all the reasons you just mentioned?
Of course. Yeah. So Ara is talking about us looking at a 4-day protocol. And that is what we're doing pretty consistently for patients in the inpatient setting now at our hospital. And I often talk to patients when there's a shorter length of stay, if they're acute pain needs that need to be managed, that, hey, there's this option where we have worked with over 20 patients and now many more than that who have not experienced precipitated withdrawal with the start. We adequately control your cravings and withdrawal with methadone, for example, as needed oxycodone, hydromorphone, other short-acting opioids. And then by day 4, we will have you up to a buprenorphine dose that can be a maintenance dose. And I go through each day, usually on a whiteboard, with explaining, here's this buprenorphine patch that goes on. It's less than 0.5 milligram. Next day, we transition to sublingual doses under the tongue. I spread out through the day, which it gets us up to 3 milligrams, then 6, then 9, and then on that day we can go all the way up to 24 if you need. And I think the other piece that I like to present is to say, I'm going to check in on you every day, and we can make adjustments as we go. And the point is to be flexible and pivot if we need. But it's been very successful for our team.
And I'll just add, I think that this new protocol that we're using, it really highlights how fast things change in addiction medicine. We started doing this maybe about 18 months ago, and we'd looked at a bunch of different protocols that were out there that other hospitals were doing and tried to adapt it to what we had available. And the reason that we did this is because often when people are doing these longer low-dose buprenorphine initiations, they're taking 5, 7, sometimes 10 days, people were getting discharged halfway through. Mm-hmm. Or there was, people were making an argument to try to extend the hospitalization. And then it came up, well, you can't keep someone in the hospital just for opioid withdrawal management, so we have to discharge them. And we weren't really sure how well people were able to complete the buprenorphine initiations if they were only halfway through and still in pain or still in withdrawal. And so a couple other hospitals had been speeding this up. And we thought, well, I think we should give this a try. And we did. And within 18 months, it's become the standard of what we do for the vast majority of our patients.
And on that note, can you walk us through, like, day by day, you know, just really walk us through what your protocol looks like? And I'm assuming, too, you're just kind of keeping somebody's full agonist sort of the same through that point. So what would, like, day one look like, day two, day three, day four?
Yes. So we keep the full agonist on through the first 3 days. Day one is a buprenorphine 20 microgram per hour patch. And that's all for day one. We just place the patch. Day two is a sublingual buprenorphine 1 milligram 3 times a day. Day three is buprenorphine sublingual 1 milligram every 3 hours for 6 doses. So we're getting up to 6 milligrams on day three. And then on day four, the way our protocol is written, we give an additional 1 milligram dose around 6 a.m. so that within about 24 hours, someone's gotten 7 milligrams, and then 8 milligrams starting at 9 a.m. And then people can go on to get additional doses if needed. They can get another 4 to 8 milligrams a few hours later, but all the way up to 24 to 32 milligrams on day four. So they can get up to their whatever is going to be their maintenance dose within about 72 hours or 3 midnights.
Well, thank you both, Elisa and Amelia, for telling us kind of how you walk through with patients, both on the whiteboard and kind of that day-by-day description that y'all just gave. And I wonder, there are a lot of different formulations. I've heard you say the word patch. I've heard sublingual. There's, you know, something about a cheek or a buccal film. How do you all kind of manage those different formulations and kind of how do they get integrated into your low-dose bup starts?
Sure, Ira. I want to first shout out one of our co-authors, Emily Skogrand, who's a addiction medicine focused pharmacist on our team, and really has a lot of expertise in this area. And we really were lucky to work with her on this publication. And so thinking about the different formulations of buprenorphine is going to really differ based on your institution in the inpatient setting. So we're talking about buccal film, which is for indication for chronic pain, but can be very expensive, but is sometimes typically on formulary for hospitals. There's also an IV formulation that can be used. When we checked in on that as an option in our institution, we anticipated that there might be some nervousness from bedside RN staff just because it was not as familiar to them. So that was not what we used for our day one start of our low-dose protocols. And then finally, there's the transdermal patch, and we utilized 20 microgram doses. And the onset for it has a steady state of 3 days, but there's actual serum concentration that can occur sooner. And that has been an effective way for us to get a small amount of bup on board to not lead to precipitated withdrawal.
I think just to highlight too, sorry, the variety in some of the protocols, like our hospital, we can't use the transdermal patch when we do these. So we do kind of like a 5 day of starting with the buckle, 300 mcg twice a day. Then day two, we use 450 mcg of the buckle three times a day. Then day three, we finally switch to the buprenorphine sublingual, where we're doing 2 milligrams three times a day. Day four, we use sublingual 4 milligrams three times a day. And on day five, we use sublingual 8 milligrams twice a day. I don't know, Ira, if you use something similar or have variation. We'll link to all these in the show notes. I think we just want to give a sense that there's actually a lot of protocols out there and they work, and we don't have really evidence to support like which are superior or better or in what situation some may work best other than like just practical clinical context.
No, Carolyn, I think you're exactly right. I also think there's a ton of regional variability because I'm also on the West Coast in California, and we are all about the transdermal patch. We're like, give me one, give me two, let's do this. Give me four even. So I think sometimes it's kind of what your hospital has. And I think what's been amazing is just the amount of collegiality and kind of sharing of protocols. And I think it's just wonderful also for, you know, us having you all on the show and talking about this is that I've also emailed people and just been like, what are you doing at your institution, East Coast, middle of the country, West Coast, you know, please share. And people are so willing to share and kind of get out their protocols and ones that are working for the patients saying like, this is the one that is the most comfortable, which I'm going to use as a transition to our next question. I wonder, Lisa, could you walk us through maybe in speaking to patients, how you actually explain these starts? Because I know we're talking about day one, day two, day three, and kind of from a clinician standpoint, but what do you actually say to the patient?
Yeah, I have a whole script that I use when I'm explaining this to patients. And this is something I adapted from Dr. Honora Englander, who leads our addiction medicine consult team. So one of the first things that I want to reassure patients about is I tell them we're going to treat your acute withdrawal with full agonist opioids while we get their buprenorphine started. So I think that's everyone's biggest concern is, am I going to experience withdrawal and pain while I'm trying to get on buprenorphine? And so that's the first thing I say is, don't worry, we're going to have other medicines available while this is getting started. And then here's what we're going to do. We're going to sneak the buprenorphine in there a little bit at a time. And this is going to be different than a traditional start. And in a traditional start, it's like jumping out of a third story window. You got to wait and wait and wait. And then all of a sudden you get hit with this high dose of buprenorphine. But doing a low dose start is like walking down the stairs. You just get a little bit at a time, and then you gently get transitioned onto buprenorphine that way. And patients really seem to like the analogy because they're like, yes, the last time I started buprenorphine, it was like jumping out of a window. I want to take the stairs this time. And so that's gone really well as I've tried to explain how this may be different to other times that they've tried to do a buprenorphine start.
Amelia, do you use a similar kind of window stairs building situation, or do you adapt it in your own way?
Yeah, I think imagery is super helpful. I think another one that I've used and I've heard colleagues use is that you're driving in this super fast car and you're planning to slowly pump the brakes, getting down to a speed that's more comfortable. So just a way to describe a more gradual process that doesn't feel so yucky.
This is such a wonderful option to have for patients. But again, I think of it as one of a couple of options. So in your guys' opinion, we've talked a little bit about this, but could somebody just briefly summarize what are ideal patients to consider for low-dose buprenorphine starts?
So I think it's, you know, as Amelia and I were saying earlier, it's really become the standard of what we do in the hospital, but it may not be right for everyone. There are some patients who are only on short-acting opioids. Maybe we're only going to have another 24 hours to work with them. We're working on a real tight time crunch. And they want to get onto buprenorphine as quickly as possible. For example, someone who is just taking prescribed oxycodone, they feel like they can wait 12 hours and then do a traditional buprenorphine initiation. A low-dose start may not be appropriate for that patient. Another situation may be, you know, just thinking about these more rapid low-dose starts versus kind of going slower. in my expert opinion, you know, once someone is on 80 plus milligrams a day of methadone, it seems like these don't go as well. If someone is using really, really high doses of opioids, it can be more challenging. And certainly, you know, we see that too with people using non-prescribed fentanyl. But I would say that for people who are chronically on methadone, doing this very, very slowly over 7 to 10 days seems to go better than the more rapid version. And then I'll also just add that for anybody who would prefer not to be on buprenorphine, we also do counsel patients about alternatives, including methadone, but also there are many barriers to access. And so it may not be a reasonable option for a number of patients, especially people living in rural areas.
And I'm curious as well, so this is really helpful, but what are some common challenges that may occur, you know, as you start this low-dose protocol, and how may you sort of adjust your protocol depending on what's happening?
So I can speak to that a little bit. I think especially as we were rolling out this protocol in the hospital, the third day of the protocol is a little bit challenging because it asks that patients take 1 milligram of buprenorphine every 3 hours. From a nursing standpoint, that's pretty frequent care, and so it could be challenging. And we noticed that early on, sometimes people weren't getting all 6 of the doses, that sometimes doses would be missed, or the patient would go to the OR or something, they would be asleep and they wouldn't get the doses. And so a lot of the work we did early on was providing nursing education, developing nursing communication dot phrases in our electronic health record, to, you know, educating our staff on how important it is that everyone get all of those doses. And if they didn't, we would want them to repeat that day, because if someone had only gotten 3 milligrams of buprenorphine, we wouldn't want to jump to 8+ milligrams the next day in that case. And so catching when those situations were coming up was probably one of the biggest challenges with our rapid protocol. Other challenges that you've seen, Amelia?
Yeah, thanks, Elisa. I think one thing also is to make sure that you're on top of controlling any opioid withdrawal or cravings, and just the risk of undertreating that, because the protocols are really not going to be successful if that's not managed well. And I know Lisa mentioned this, but explaining with a lot of education to nurses about what we're doing, what's happening, why it's so important that their patient's getting full agonists as well as the buprenorphine at the same time. Those are some other things to think about too.
Well, that actually brings up a great point that y'all mentioned. And Amelia, I think you talked about your incredible pharmacy colleague too. And we know, like, it takes a village to raise a bup protocol. So I'm just wondering, like, how did y'all kind of get all the stakeholders on board? It sounds like there was nursing education. Like, y'all are two people with not an infinite amount of time. You know, how are you making this protocol, you know, how are you birthing this protocol into your hospital and making it come to existence? Because a rapid 4-day one does take a lot of, like, buy-in and education. I'm just wondering if you could, you know, for a second speak about that process.
Sure, I can speak to that. And I think it's many of the things that have already been mentioned is just we are so fortunate to work as part of a large consult team. And so having our pharmacist partner with us to provide education for the pharmacy team about what we were doing. And then also she was incredibly helpful in providing nursing education as well. A lot of what I did on my end was provider education. So meeting with our addiction consult providers to let them know we're rolling out this protocol. We want people to try it. We're tracking all the cases. We're collecting data. We want to know how this is going. And if people are running into problems, please tell us, because that's how we found out about issues that were coming up. Like, people are having trouble getting through all the doses on day 3. And really, I think we approached it with a quality improvement attitude. We tried it out on a small number of patients, saw that it was going well, and then expanded it from there.
And going back just really quickly to before, I think, Amelia, you raised an important point that sometimes patients may be having a little bit of opioid withdrawal during this time. So how are you managing that? Are you increasing the full opioid agonists? Are you slowing down your low-dose protocol?
That's a great question, Carolyn. And I think part of it is obviously, as we know, driven based on the case and what's happening. If there's room to go up on the methadone and that's what a patient's on, that's one route. If we think that we're going too quickly with the bup dosing, I often chat with the patient and say, hey, what would you like to do? Would you like to slow down and repeat a day? That's a great option as well. And I think just problem solving with that patient. But first step, probably adjusting the full agonist and then offering slowing down on the buprenorphine titration.
I'll just put on my psychiatry hat for a second. I think another thing too is just addressing the fear and anxiety that people have when they're in the hospital. And there could be so many different factors at play, but being able to give a name to that and talk about it, I think could be really powerful as well. And also using adjuncts. We built an order set around this in our electronic health record, and it has all the adjuncts just waiting to be clicked to add on to help our patients get through some of the withdrawal that comes through as they're going through this. So clonidine, hydroxyzine, trazodone, loperamide, ondansetron, tizanidine, all of those are part of our standard order set when we're doing low-dose buprenorphine initiations, whether we're doing the rapid one or our slower one. And actually, it's part of our traditional initiation protocol too. So we very much use our adjuncts to help patients as well.
I appreciate y'all sharing kind of the different challenges that you've experienced rolling this out in the inpatient setting. I wonder how this varies based on clinical setting. And Amelia, I think what I recall is you do some work in the clinic in the outpatient setting as well. And I just wonder how have y'all adapted this to the outpatient setting and maybe kind of both opportunities and maybe any challenges that you've experienced kind of rolling that out there?
Yeah, Ira, happy to talk about that. So I work in Harbor Clinic, and we're a harm reduction and bridges to care, and it's telemedicine. And in that setting, just pointing out, we used to be brick and mortar, but transitioned during the pandemic, so a bit of a specific space. But we've actually adapted one of the protocols from inpatient, which is about 6 to 7 days long. And then we also have a 4-day protocol, which we took directly from Dr. Suen et al. At the Bridge Clinic in San Francisco. And then we also offer traditional injection. And I think the big picture is that we're offering patients choice, and it's a shared decision with that provider. To talk about some challenges and unique aspects of being an outpatient, I think it's important to highlight that unlike the inpatient setting, if a patient's using illicit substances and they want to do a low-dose protocol, we are not allowed as providers per the Harrison Narcotics Tax Act to prescribe full agonist opioids to control their opioid withdrawal. So the understanding is that if they do a low-dose induction, that they're going to be using unprescribed opiates or illicit opioids in order to manage their opioid withdrawal for that period. So I think our clinic really makes sure we talk with patients through overdose prevention, naloxone prescribing, detailed safer use strategies, even though patients are very knowledgeable, but balancing those risks and the benefits of a start. And then I think the other piece, we talked about buprenorphine formulations in the hospital. There are limitations around that in the outpatient setting. And for us, what we're able to offer is to cut sublingual tablets and films. It is not perfect, but we recommend folks to use a pill cutter if they have it or back of a knife. One of my colleagues says to cut films in a little plastic bag so they don't fly away. And it's just one way we can start that first, you know, handful of days when we have to go lower than 4 or 2 milligrams. But I think it's so important for people to have different ways to get onto bup if they're particularly using street fentanyl. And then finally, I think a challenge can be framed as a positive is if it doesn't go well the first, second, third time, we're still here to pivot and try and talk about if this isn't working, do you want to reattempt or can we offer some other options as well?
It's so challenging to cut the films and the tablets. Mm-hmm. We're really lucky here. Speaking of partnerships, you know, with pharmacies and pharmacists, we like managed to get a pharmacy to create like little bubble packs. So they'll actually pre-cut the tablets, which is really great. But of course, the challenge is it's like one pharmacy and a sea of thousands of pharmacies that folks can go to. So it may not be accessible.
And I was just thinking a pharmacy, like a sea of the pharmacy. Sorry.
Yes.
we introduced the pun in the middle of the episode. Everyone hates it. Sorry.
I was just thinking how much we need bubble packing for our Bridge Clinic. Like, we really need it. We just started bubble packing. If people start a low dose start in the hospital and they leave partway through, we just got the ability to bubble pack the rest of their buprenorphine when they discharge. We really need that for our Bridge Clinic. I feel like that would be incredibly helpful.
Well, I was going to say, I feel like between Lisa and Amelia, your inpatient work, and then Carolyn, this one pharmacy that's crushing the bubble pack, quite literally meant that one too. Yeah. I just feel like I'm in a selfish question. I also have trouble, like when I prescribe these types of low dose bup starts in the outpatient world, I find myself having to write everything out and just explain kind of very meticulously, which is hard when you have 15 minutes to see a patient, at least in my clinic, to really go through it in the way that it deserves when you don't have a bubble pack or you don't have like a perfectly kind of made pack, which, you know, the clinic that you're referencing, Amelia, is kind of one of our outpatient buprenorphine clinics that has a pharmacy in it, actually, and is incredible. They've like, you know, wrote about these protocols and had their kind of packs ready to go, and it's wonderful. But not all pharmacies are willing to engage in that strategy, which is a bummer. And I wonder, it sounds like with your Bridge Clinic and the initiations you do, y'all are also not yet, you know, doing the bubble pack. So how do you, like, is it multiple calls with the telehealth program that you're checking in to remind people kind of, okay, it's day three. Remember, this is the every 3 hour day and remember to cut it. Like, how are you all actually, like, what are the mechanics of that?
Yeah, so I think I wish that we had a bubble packing arrangement with a pharmacy. I think one of the real strengths of our clinic is that we're serving patients across the whole state virtually. But I think as a result, a lot of the work we're doing is education, like within patient messaging on the electronic medical record. But all of the providers, I think, standardly write a MyChart message to patients that has kind of a step-by-step of what they're taking every single day. And I sometimes talk to patients about checking off what you've taken each day to ensure that it's done, putting it in pill box if you can. And some of my colleagues, and I've tried to do this myself as well, we'll call when we're nervous about rural pharmacies who we think might be less familiar with the protocol. And we'll often also get calls back to us from pharmacists saying, hey, did you mean to send this? And then in terms of patients following up, we do have kind of a tight turnaround and our schedule's flexible. We see patients even if they come at a different time than expected. So on the 4-day protocol, we have them come back like on day 4, ideally, or day 3. And then we have some amazing peer recovery specialists on our team who are often in phone communication with patients and can sort of let us know amongst the team if patients are having a hard time. And then we pop folks in to make adjustments.
That is one thing I've just continued to be so impressed by with the harm reduction and Bridges Clinic is just the access, like people being able to get same day or next day appointments, being able to check in with people frequently. I know access is just such a huge issue. It's such a cool thing about that clinic.
So true. And also like the low barrier way that the access is happening where it's like, do you need a same day? Do you need a same day visit, same day prescription? Mm-hmm. It's aspirational for those of us with maybe less great access. Carolyn, maybe we could ask Elisa and Amelia to tell us if there's anything about the, you know, rapid low dose start, especially that y'all have published on your recent paper that we haven't mentioned, like aspects of this that you feel like you're most proud of, most surprised by, and anything that, you know, would be important for listeners who are maybe thinking about doing this themselves at their hospitals or their Bridges clinics.
So I would say that some of the, I've used it in a few situations that I didn't expect to and had it go really well. And a few of those were things like for patients who, with a number of patients who came in, who were pregnant and came in labor and delivered, and we only had 72 hours and they wanted to get on buprenorphine, and we were able to do that with this protocol. And so I think that's a really unique population of patients where this could be applied to. And I didn't necessarily expect that when we started. I would also say that we've also had a few cases where we've been able to use it to rapidly get people onto extended release buprenorphine, which is the monthly injectable. And I think that's a wonderful opportunity as well. If you have a limited time with someone and they want to be on a long acting agent, and that's a good opportunity.
Well, it's been so great having both of you here with us today. Do you guys have any just main take-home points for our listeners?
I think the main take-home points I have, if I could drive anything home about this protocol, is just the importance of treating the acute withdrawal cravings and pain. Those first, even if you're doing a rapid low dose or a longer low dose, treating that until someone is on at least 8+ milligrams of buprenorphine. Really lower doses than that, I don't expect would be high enough to treat acute withdrawal, acute opioid withdrawal. And so being really mindful of using other medications, if you're in the hospital setting and have the ability to prescribe them to treat the withdrawal, that I think that the times where I've seen this not go as well is when we've undertreated the acute withdrawal. So if I could drive one thing home, that's what I would want to say.
I think a pearl I would drive home is the importance of patient education and explaining the protocol and the pharmacokinetics of the different drugs that we're talking about. And I think in making sure they understand the process, it's an opportunity to build trust with that individual. And as we know, a lot of patients we're taking care of have really real reasons to mistrust the health system. So I think involving them in that process has been meaningful and really key to having protocols go well.
Oh my gosh, Carolyn, don't hate me. But before we ask about what Elisa and Amelia want to plug, Amelia, just your comment just reminded me, and I can't believe I hadn't asked this, but would y'all be able to share kind of how patients feel about this rapid, you know, 4-day protocol? Because I feel like your incredible paper kind of shares these models and like shares the percentages of precipitated withdrawal and everything and who completed the initiations. But are there like quotes or themes, or maybe I'm linking to a future paper that y'all have coming out, who knows, a qualitative one. But I just wonder, like, the patients are the person who's at the center of all this and why we're trying to do this. So I just wonder, have y'all heard from patients that this is working and that they like it, and, you know, what their perceptions have been?
Sure. This would be just my one experience from seeing patients and hearing back. I think majority of patients I'm seeing are really relieved that there's an opportunity for them to get on a medication like buprenorphine, if that is their goal, in a way that is more comfortable and isn't so prolonged, lowering anxiety, risk of not having good withdrawal management, not good pain control. Thinking about a plug, the Harbor Clinic, some of my colleagues are actually starting a study around shared decision making and doing qualitative interviews to capture patients' experiences of different protocols. So I think it'll be a nice chance in that setting to hear what patients' experiences and thoughts are.
And I'll just say on my end that I've generally, patients have told me that they feel well supported going through this protocol. As long as we're managing their acute withdrawal and keeping people as comfortable as possible, at least in the hospital setting, I've generally gotten good feedback when people are doing low-dose buprenorphine starts and even our more rapid protocol.
And is there anything you want to plug, Lisa, in that?
Oh, gosh. So I guess I will put in a plug for a few things. I was thinking about this and really some of the challenges as providers. And I feel so fortunate to work in a health system that has a really robust addiction medicine program. And I know that there are a lot of providers out there that are maybe in more rural settings, or they may be the only person in their area that is doing this type of work, and it can feel very isolating. So I just wanted to put a plug in for a couple organizations like the American Society of Addiction Medicine. And if you have a local chapter, I've been involved with the Oregon chapter this past year, and a lot of the focus is around building community for providers who may work in more isolated areas and not have access to that community. So I want to put a plug in for that. Also, if your state has an ECHO program, we have a really robust ECHO program that provides a lot of statewide education, and that can also provide community for people who are doing this type of work. So I'll put in plugs for those cool programs. And I know some of those are specific to Oregon, but many states have chapters from ACM and ECHO programs as well.
Totally. Nobody should feel alone in doing this work, because it's really important, I think, to feel supportive and supported and have colleagues who you can reach out to troubleshoot things with, as well as just debrief on some of the unusual parts of addiction medicine that I think are really important to sort of share to prevent burnout of colleagues in our field.
And just to clarify for everyone, ECHO, as far as I understand, is like extension for community health outcomes, or kind of like maybe even telehealth programs, just to make sure that if anyone was like, what ECHO are we talking about? Is that correct, Elisa?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, thank you both. This has been wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Yes, it's been great. Thank you.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. And a special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project, as well as ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about their organization at acam.org. And a special thanks to our team for this episode, including our editor, Dr. Sarah Leidy, who I'm obsessed with and is a graduate of our program, and of course, obviously, to our whole amazing team. And The Curbsiders is produced and edited by the team at Podpaste.
A reminder that this and most episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is make an account. Until next time, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan.
And I'm Dr. Ira Krasnovska. Thank you so much for joining us today. And let us bring you a little nugget of delicious addiction medicine pearls. Yummy.